Hi, good afternoon. I'm thrilled to be here with you today. I'm Mary Kay Devine, Chief of Staff from Women Employed. I have the very esteemed honor of introducing our two moderators today. Carol Marine, co-director of the DePaul Center for Journalism, Integrity, and Excellence. I have to give all her receipts. Formerly NBC5 News and WTTW. And thank you also. Cheryl Corley is National Public Radio's acting Midwest Bureau Chief and a longtime correspondent covering the Midwest and criminal justice issues around the country. As a former reporter and news director at WBEZ Chicago, Cheryl has covered several mayoral administrations. Please visit ChicagoWomenTakeAction.org, and you will find the candidate questionnaire and the responses on the homepage of ChicagoWomenTakeAction.org. All right, let's get into it.
Hello, everyone. I'm really glad to be here today. I'm Cheryl Corley, as just mentioned.
And I'm Carol Marine. We're just really thrilled to see you today. We're going to make a clip right along if we can.
You know, next 2 hours, we'll explore some of the tough challenges facing the next mayor of the city of Chicago through the lens of critical issues, many of which disproportionately affect women.
We'll hear from 8 of the 9 candidates. Cam Buckner, unfortunately, had an emergency and could not be here. And here they are in alphabetical order. Congressman Jesus Chuy Garcia.
Activist and entrepreneur Jamal Green.
Cook County Commissioner, I just moved this away, forgive me. Cook County Commissioner Brandon Johnson, forgive me.
Alderwoman Sophia King.
Mayor Lori Lightfoot.
Alderman Roderick Sawyer.
Former CEO of Chicago Public Schools, Paul Vallis.
And businessman Willie Wilson. You know, thanks to everyone who is in our audience and to everyone watching at home, thanks to CAN TV and to Facebook Live, we're going to begin with some of the ground rules. Our forum is not a formal debate.
There will be no opening statements, no closing statements, and no filibustering, please. We ask each candidate to respond directly to our questions.
There is a time limit on any answer. 90 seconds. We have a timer, Tanya Woods, who is right there, and she has a loud buzzer, beeper. Our timer is not afraid to use it. So please keep your answers direct, on point, and to time, because that will help us all.
Speak, candidate, slowly if you can for our interpreter. That's her request, and we understand that she's got a hard job to do. Our audience, those were great lines, but could you hold all the rest of it until the end? We ask that because we want no cheering, no booing. We want to give all of our attention to these candidates and all of our respect.
The goal here really is to help voters gather the information they need to make an informed decision in this election. So we have broken our questions into areas. Let's begin with the first.
Crime. The violent crime rate is a complicated issue all over this country. We've heard arguments here in Chicago about defunding the police or investing in neighborhoods or both. What one immediate thing would you do to ensure public safety in the city's neighborhoods? We begin with Jesus Chuy Garcia.
90 seconds.
Hello, can you hear me? This mic is pretty weak. I assure you it's not me. As mayor of the city of Chicago, I am committed to the full implementation of the consent decree. It's been 5 years. We have fallen way too short of the recommendations and the court order that requires that implementation. Among the things that the consent decree requires is that Chicago modernize its police force, that we become a police force that is professional, that uses other best practices across the country. I would appoint a superintendent that preferably, because I want to respect the appointment process, hails from Chicago, understands neighborhoods, and embraces the urgency of restoring trust between community residents and police officers in Chicago. Similarly, a part of my plan, which I laid out yesterday at the City Club, includes investing in Chicago neighborhoods, especially those that have suffered the worst trauma and violence for many, many years of disinvestment. I would also ensure that we lift up the next generation of command officers in Chicago who also embrace modernization and professionalization and understand the urgency of that.
Thank you, Congressman. Jamal Green, 90 seconds.
Thank you. Whoa. One again.
There you go.
Are we here? All right. We are going to take a different approach when it comes to public safety. We are not going to continue having the politicians that do the same thing over and over again and talk about police when that does not solve our crises. We are going to address public safety holistically and attack the root causes of public safety in this city. That means that we are going to invest into people and invest into communities, from creating new 10,000 new homeowners each year, from increasing the affordable housing units, from also incentivizing folks to develop on vacant lots, from a program to give folks in poverty $1,000 a month to give them a foundation to push them out of poverty. We're going to reopen up the mental health facilities that were shut down many years ago. We're going to have a citywide jobs program for young people to have apprenticeships all throughout the city from 13 years old and up so that they have an alternative. We're going to have tech hubs and trade programs all throughout the city to give them a pipeline to middle-class jobs. We are going to invest in communities and then have CPD as a support system to all of the systems that will bring forth economic prosperity, prevention, and intervention in our communities.
Thank you. Brandon Johnson.
Yeah, thank you for the question. And again, I'm honored to be here today. I don't believe there's anyone on this stage that has more of an incentive for the city of Chicago to be safe than a family being raised on the west side of Chicago. My wife and I are raising three children. We've had to change windows in our home from bullets that have come through our home. We've had to cover our children countless times as gunshots have broken outside of our home. This is not news. This is something that actually exists right outside our door. And that's why our plan is very simple. There's a direct correlation between youth employment and violence reduction, right? So I'm going to have the largest youth summer hiring program that's going to be extended year-round to ensure that young people see themselves and that we are actually valuing them. Every single city agency that I have the authority over, I'm going to direct the city agencies to hire young people in the city. We're also going to ask businesses to step up and to actually hire young people and hire people from communities where violence and poverty per capita has reached a level that looks like developing nations. The second thing, the only candidate up here who has said out loud that I support the policy of treatment, not trauma. The reason why we are experiencing so much disconnect on the front lines is because we are asking way too much from our police officers. Quantonio LeGreer on the west side of Chicago, Betty, came to his aid to support as he was having a mental health crisis. The only thing on the scene were guns. They would be alive today if we actually had those critical investments. And the third thing, I fought the previous administration for closing down mental health clinics. I fought this particular administration for refusing to open them. I'm going to reopen the mental health clinics because it's personal. My brothers who've suffered mental health have been criminalized, and I'm going to make sure that the full investments exist throughout the city of Chicago. Thank you.
Thank you. Sophia King.
Stand two. My mic is working. Mic check.
Is.
One, two. Okay, my husband's a DJ. I had to say that. All right. So crime is the number one, two, and three issue in the city right now. I represent from downtown to Hyde Park with Bronzeville in the middle. The number one request I get, no matter where I am, what community I'm serving, is for more police presence. Now, we know that police aren't the only response, but we do know that because of that, there's still a respect and a reverence there. They're our brothers, our sisters, our uncles, our aunts. They're part of our community. They need to be treated as such. As I said, they're not the only solution. Violence intervention is also a huge part of our plan. We want to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on violence intervention. Unfortunately, our city council gave this administration $85 million for violence intervention in 2022, and less than $5 million was spent. We need to make sure that this is a priority in our city. We also know that over 50% of calls to 911 are for nonviolent issues like homeless insecurities, like mental health insecurities. We need to escalate the programs that our city council has allocated funds for as well. It is not a one-fix-all solution. It is all hands on deck, and I'm the leader to get this done.
Thank you. Lori Lightfoot, 90 seconds.
Well, first of all, obviously, the question of crime has been something that has plagued the city of Chicago literally for decades. What do we know that doesn't work? A law enforcement first and only strategy. What we need is a variety of tools. And the reason that we made progress year over year from 2021 to 2022 is because we have a multi-tiered strategy. Not just law enforcement, but going into the communities that are most plagued by violence and asking the people who are closest to the challenge, what is the solution? And it's a different answer in West Garfield Park than it is in Auburn Gresham. It's a different answer in Roseland than it might be in South Shore. But what we know is that if we hold violent, dangerous people accountable and take the guns out of their hands, and then we couple that with soft power strategies like investments, like making sure that street outreach has the funding, which we increase multiple fold from what we inherited, if we put mental health services that are culturally relevant in every single community, as we have done, going from serving 2,500 people to 60,000 last year, and importantly, for the first time, serving children and adolescents. And if we continue to understand that economic development is the key, when young boys see hope and opportunity at their fingertips in their neighborhoods, it makes a resounding difference. So it's got to be using all the tools in our toolkit. It's got to be collaborating with our federal partners and making communities safer, and that's what we've done.
Thank you. Roderick Sawyer, 90 seconds, please.
Thank you. In response to the question, the one thing that I would do, the one thing that I would do is empower the commission that I worked on for the last 7 years, the Empowering Commission for Public Safety, allow them and make sure, ensure and empower them to do their job, to select a superintendent that we can work together with, someone that has the support of the community, support of the rank and file, someone that can advise us on the proper strategies to do what's necessary to ramp these crime down. So the one thing that I would do, one thing, is to ensure that that commission works with me to appoint a new police superintendent. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul Vallis, 90 seconds.
Thank you. Let me also respond to your question about what is the one thing that I would do. Well, first of all, I would return to the interim Superintendent Beck's strategy of pushing the police down to the local beats. I think Wire Points last year reported that there were 400,000 911 high priority calls that came in, including 32,000 assaults and batteries for which there was not a car available. The most effective policing is community-based policing, so that there are beat cars at every beat, so that there are police officers, Chicago police officers, walking the platforms of the CTA and at the CTA stations. Officers who know the people in the community and officers who are known to the individuals in the communities. That means filling the vacancies. That means incentivizing new officers to come in. That means removing the penalties for officers who have left to return. And it means prioritizing beat integrities, because when you have half your high priority 911 calls not being responded to for because there is not a car available, that wreaks havoc. Or when you have the CTA being policed by 300 police privatized security officers who have minimal training, minimum wage, and they don't have the power of arrest, that's not ensuring that riding the CTA is a safe experience. So that is the one thing that I would prioritize, the return to real community-based policing, beat integrity.
Thank you. Finally, Willie Wilson for 90 seconds.
Yeah. I would say this, is that crime is personal to me. I have a 20-year-old son shot and killed, drug related. I would probably approach a little differently. I would take the handcuff off the police and put them on a truck. People who actually did it, commit all these crimes thing. I would back out a police officer. I would take these strict rules off of them. I would use common sense. A person that runs and when they commit a crime, I would get that police officer the right to track them down and to chase them down. These rules that you have right now are not common sense rules. You know, I would put more, I put armed security on the CTA. I would take, then communicate with the community in terms of getting input from the community. I would take and put four police superintendent. If we got 50 aldermen trying to run this city, well, and one superintendent of police, that don't make sense. You put four, you divide them up, you hold them accountable. Then that makes sense to me. Lastly, in terms of this crime situation, we got to get a little tough. We have to be tough. You know, we cannot be saying that someone had a right when they've been shot and killed somebody. When they're talking about they got the right, what about the right the person had that they killed?
Thank you.
I said they got no rights.
Thank you very much.
We'll continue now with another question about crime, but let's talk about a more hidden violence epidemic. According to the University of Chicago Crime Lab, the city receives around 500 calls to 911 for domestic violence incidents every day. Most of the people harmed are women, and the problem actually grew during the epidemic. So what immediate step would you take to address gender-based violence? Let's begin with Jamal Green.
Sorry, Brandon.
A cooperative spirit.
They gave us mics that didn't work, sorry. This is a real issue in our city, that women are the most unprotected people in the city of Chicago, especially when it comes to gender-based violence, domestic violence. And I've had so many cases that I've helped where there were situations where they had people that were coming after them, and the police were not able, the police didn't give them a response, and then they went down to file an order of protection. And then they found out the subject found out about the order of protection and ended up killing them before anything was ever done. These situations happen each and every day. We must make sure that we put measures in place so that we can respond better when there is evidence of a possible crime, especially against women in the city of Chicago. They feel unprotected. They feel like there is no one there that can respond and give them the support that they need immediately. And if there is somebody there that is responding in a way where they know violence could happen, we must be there to protect them, and we will under our administration.
Thank you. Brandon Johnson, 90 seconds.
Thank you very much. You know, I'm the only person on this stage that actually worked to pass legislation in our budget at the county level to put millions of dollars into violence prevention. And we are experiencing the results of those investments now. Look, it's why I've been a big supporter of the Pretrial Safety Act, you know, which provides the necessary support for women who have experienced domestic violence. And it's also why I pushed on the county board to make sure that we have additional resources to have 24 hours access for women who have experienced domestic violence. You know, look, we already know that one in three women are likely to experience domestic violence. And as mayor of Chicago, just like I've done as an organizer, as a Cook County commissioner, we're going to use the office of the mayor to make sure that there are critical investments and treatment facilities available for women who are oftentimes placed in vulnerable situations. I think the last thing is the workplace violence that exists in many of our workspaces, making sure that I'm doing everything in my power to institute and pass policy ordinances to provide more workplace support so women do not have to continue to be subject to the type of harassment and brutality that exists for too long in this country. Thank you.
Thank you. Sophia King, 90 seconds.
Yes, I agree with the commissioner that violence intervention is part and should be a priority in our city. As I said earlier, we gave the administration $85 million to spend on violence intervention. Less than $5 million is out the door. I also had a group, a nonprofit group, that came to us because their priority was transgender African-American women. And they came to me because they weren't receiving equitable treatment in terms of distribution of funds at the Department of Health. If we don't prioritize the same people who are experiencing the inequities, then we are not going to get to the root cause of it. Our CDPH department spends hundreds of millions of dollars in our communities. Less than 1% goes to women and procurement for women. Less than 3% to African Americans. Less than 2% to Latinos. We have to prioritize equity. Equity didn't just happen to us. Inequity didn't. It's intentional. We have to be intentional about funding these things, and if they're not going to the people who are disproportionately experiencing the lack of resources, then they're not going to get to the people who need them the most. So we need to prioritize that in our funding and everywhere else. That's true equity.
Lori Lightfoot.
Well, what we know over the last 2 years, particularly because of the compelled togetherness of the pandemic, that domestic violence, both in homicides and shooting, has skyrocketed, not only in Chicago, but across the country. It is a major driver of our homicide rate. It's a complicated issue that, in my view, doesn't have a law enforcement solution. But the reason that we are making progress is because we have the first ever gender-based violence and human trafficking strategic plan in the city's history. There is a team that works in my office that reports directly to me specifically on gender-based violence and human trafficking. We are taking strides and dealing with the police department and, frankly, making them more responsive to calls of domestic violence. And we're working with the advocates. Our policies are informed by my sitting directly with victims, with advocates, and making sure that their lived experience is actually reflected in our policies. And we will be taking even more strides. I've got to spend part of my time, though, correcting one thing that Alderman King said. We announced a program of $1.2 billion in investments. And we have, as of the end of 2022, spent almost $350 million, Alderwoman. And a huge percentage of that is on violence reduction measures. So I can't let you keep repeating the thing that's wrong that you said during the budget. $5 million. We've spent hundreds of millions of dollars to keep our people, and particularly our women and our youth, safe.
Thank you so much. Roderick Sawyer, 90 seconds.
Thank you. In response, I must disagree with one portion of the mayor's statement in that it's not a law enforcement problem. A portion of it is, and it's inherent in your question, 500 calls a day to 911 as relates to domestic violence issues. The problem that we have, and I think Mr. Vallis touched on it a moment ago, is that we need to increase our service response. So if we're actually talking about attacking the problem directly is resolving the issue, making sure that offender is brought to justice and we can move forward and also give that victim the resources that are necessary. But it starts with the call. And if the call is not responded to, that's going to increase that person's anxiety. That's going to see that the city's not working for me because I had a call of domestic violence and no one's showing up to provide assistance to me. So let's start with the call first. Response to the call, making sure we give that person, that victim, the services that they deserve, and making sure that that offender is brought to justice. And that justice may include counseling, it may include whatever we feel is necessary, but it's also going to include some punishment, because there's no place for domestic violence anywhere in the city of Chicago. And as mayor, that's not going to happen. We're going to work to make sure that people understand the severity and the consequences of their actions are going to be dealt with swiftly and immediately. Thank you.
Paul Vallis, 90 seconds.
That's pretty hard to improve upon, Rob. I just want to point that out. Look, it boils down to response time. 406,000 high-priority cases not responded to. 32,000 assaults and batteries in progress for which there was not a car available. How many of those tens of thousands of cases were cases of domestic violence? I come from a family of four police officers. Domestic violent cases are sometimes half their calls. So you need to have the beat integrity, so you have police officers on that local beat who know the community, who sometimes know the offenders, who sometimes know the victims, so that they can respond in real time. And there's also the issue of follow-up. When they need to respond, they need to take action. They need to have the power to make arrests. They need to have to be able to be proactive when it comes to dealing with domestic violence situations. Because as Jamal pointed out, these things escalate into more violent crimes. And the police need the resources to return to that home, to do a follow-up. It's just not a one-off. It's just not a one-time visit. There needs to be a sustained presence so the abuser knows that they're going to be followed and there's going to be accountability. And finally, we need to provide alternative placements for those women who are in danger. And those alternative placements need to be in every community. But at the end of the day, as Rod pointed out, it begins with that call. It begins with that police officer knowing the community and sometimes knowing the house and sometimes going back, because the really effective police officers sometimes return to that scene themselves just to check and see how things are going. Thank you.
Willie Wilson, 90 seconds, please.
I believe that what we have to do is put more resources in police department in order to investigate these particular situations so they can get to them. I think last year the National Center for Missing Exploratory People, particularly for people of color, I think it was 64,000 Black women and children, a lot of them out of Chicago, and you had something like a lot of 200 people was missing, women of color. Nobody was able to investigate them, and they're still missing today. But as related to all women, regardless of what creed or color that you might be, you need the resources. But I will say this: put a office in a put a female committee in the office of the mayor so we can get right to the point. And those particular problems can come to the mayor's office, and they better to equip to deal with it than particular men's, and let them report to that and do it that way. I think that that's a serious problem that needs to be worked out with the women's and with the police force backing, but have enough resource to investigate all the situation.
Thank you. And last for the question, Jesus Chuy Garcia, 90 seconds.
Domestic violence is the number one killer of women, and we need to get serious about addressing it and stopping it. The threat of violence and harassment, it's what denies women the right to participate more fairly in the economy. And harassment is the leading cause of injury to women. In the United States Congress, I have worked to bring unprecedented funding to state and local governments to the tune of $4.4 billion, $700 million in the Violence Against Women Prevention and Prosecution Grants, and $225 million to address sexual assault kit and other DNA evidence backlogs. In addition to that, in my public safety plan, which I unveiled yesterday, We address how to deal with domestic violence calls to the Chicago Police Department, how to address similar calls from the LGBTQ community, and the need to address other hate crimes as it relates to Muslims and Jews and other racial and immigrant minorities as well. This is the type of transformation that the department needs so that police officers can deal with violence and crimes that are serious while we deal with the right approach to addressing other needs that people have, including responding respectfully to women's needs.
Thank you very much. Our next area is homelessness. The Chicago Coalition for the Homeless put the number of unhoused people at more than 65,000 as of 2020. Drive around the city, look under the viaducts, go past the parks. You'll see tents. In some cases, you'll see whole tent encampments. Name, please, one significant, immediate step you would take as mayor to address this health and human rights issue. Let's begin, please, with Brandon Johnson for 90 seconds.
Thank you for that question. As a public school teacher, I can tell you firsthand what homelessness looks like. 20,000 homeless students that are documented in the public schools, 65,000 unhoused throughout the city of Chicago. It's why I am a supporter with the organizers calling for a real estate transfer tax that can have a dedicated revenue stream to make sure that we're dealing with this crisis. And look, you know, I have an older brother who was my hero, Leon, and he was beautiful. Had a Jerry curl and everything back in the day. And he had untreated trauma and died addicted and unhoused. I believe his life would be better if we actually had political leadership that understood the value of treating individuals who are struggling from mental health. What we have on this stage, unfortunately, is ostensibly a group of Democrats that still believe in locking people up and criminalizing them. That has failed. There's no one on this stage that has greater incentive to make sure that this city works than someone who's raising a family on the west side of Chicago. The police budget is one of the biggest budgets that we've seen in the history of this city. We are spending more money to lock people up than house them. That is unjust. As mayor of Chicago, I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that no one is too poor to live in one of the richest cities, in one of the richest countries, at the wealthiest time in the history of the world.
Thank you. Sophia King for 90 seconds.
Thank you. As I was saying earlier, over 50% of calls to 911 are for non-violent issues. Therefore, issues like homeless insecurity, like mental health insecurities. So we need to put support towards over 50% of calls that come in. That's not what police are trained to do. So we need to bring the people who are trained to do this. My caucus, the Progressive Caucus, led an effort to push mental health first responders and to put them in districts. There are three pilots out there. They only are out there for several hours during the day. We need to escalate those pilots. They need to be escalated. We need to spend the money that we have allocated and put those on the streets. We also had a homeless encampment on Harrison Street that we spent a lot of time dealing with the department on that. We need more housing out there. That's the issue. We don't have housing for homeless, and those issues around mental health and homeless issues are intertwined. There is money in the budget for these things. We need to prioritize and allocate those funds. I will leave by saying, you know, people figure, but figures don't lie.
Thank you. Lori Lightfoot for 90 seconds.
Well, as anybody who has tended to the homeless in our city can tell you, whether it's walking in the streets, whether it's in the encampments, whether it's in our shelters, there are many reasons why people end up on the street. It could be financial, it could be mental health, it could be substance abuse or some combination of the above. That's why you have to have a multi-tiered strategy to meet people where they are. It's complicated when people live on the street for a long time. believe it or not, many people don't want to come in because they're untrusting of government and they're afraid. So we've got to have, as we have, put money into lots of different strategies, increase the size of the budget for the people who are working full-time on these jobs, increase the number of low-barrier shelters, increase the amount of housing, but also the wraparound services are what's critically important. That is why we've increased our mental health budget sevenfold since I became mayor. That is why we've increased the funding for substance abuse treatment centers multiple times since I become mayor. We are working diligently on this issue every single day. And the people that are out there, I believe that no one in our city, none of God's children, should be living on the street. But we've got to work diligently to make sure that we create that bond of trust to get them into housing and get them into the wraparound services. And that is what the diligent teams at DFSS are doing every single day.
Thank you. Roderick Sawyer, 90 seconds.
Thank you. The mayor might be surprised to hear this, but I really agree with a lot of what you just stated. This is the situation, and I deal with homeless people quite often as my job as alderman. And the one common thread that I will say when we walk up to homeless people and we bring DFSS or the military, depending on the station of life, the homeless individuals, 9 times out of 10, refuse service. So the immediate step is to understand why they're homeless, what we need to do to assist them. And it may not be immediately housing. It may be mental health services, drug addiction, like we're stating, all types of wraparound services. A tax is not the immediate step. I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I'm just saying it's not the immediate step to resolve what's hurting someone so much that they'd rather live on the street than live in a shelter. And let's be honest, some of the shelters are just, they just don't trust the shelters. They don't want to be involved in the shelters. They'd rather be with a community of their own on Harrison Street, underneath a viaduct. At least they're all together and they can protect each other. We have to understand that better. Because I'm going to tell you, sometimes I get calls regarding a homeless person on the street, but you know what that caller wants? They want them to go away. They don't want to help them. They just don't want to see them. So that's the challenge that we have as a city, to do more, to do better on how we can really help the homeless, get them the services that they need, get them employment, training, and jobs, and get them an opportunity to be functional. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul Vallis, 90 seconds.
You know, that 66,000 figure points to the larger issue of affordable housing in general, because so many, you have the homeless people and you also have people, 3 or 4 families living in the same building, and obviously through the period of COVID, things have become much worse. So you've got to attack the longer-term affordable housing issue by removing the obstacles to implementing and building more affordable housing, really lifting the restrictions on allowing the 100,000 plus apartment owners convert improved space, unimproved space to garden units. It could create over 100,000 affordable units right now. And you've got to cap local property taxes. I mean, how many people felt that their local property taxes were, you know, that the city held the line on local property taxes? We've increased property taxes close to $900 million since 2019, despite $6 billion in COVID money coming from the city and the schools. So at the end of the day, we have got to also to address that issue so we're not creating new homeless by driving people out of their homes. But as my colleague said, and as my good friend said, we've got to get at the underlying causes of the hardcore homeless, and that sometimes goes beyond just finding them either temporary or even permanent space, because there are many reasons why people become homeless in the first place. So that means we've got to assess and evaluate the needs of that individual, because we have to address that needs, because all too often a person has found shelter and then that person ends up on the street again. So we have to address the underlying causes. Thank you.
Willie Wilson, please, 90 seconds.
My opinion on this here, look, we come from a family, 11, and we were poor, very poor. Didn't have food to eat. This past year, we've given away personally about $250,000, $500,000 to the homeless in Tent City. We've given away money around this country since the last 30 years, over $60 to $70 million. many people. Every penny we make, we give it away. You know, I think that they got it wrong up here, some of us. The mayor is giving automatic raises when people's homeless. The mayor and city council are getting raises while people can't get gasoline and get to work. They don't have money to pay for food. And after COVID-19 messed with us all. And they still giving themselves raises. It's wrong. They're not thinking nobody but about the homeless. They think about themselves. When we become mayor of City Hall, we cut it all out. I don't want a paycheck. We do this to help the people. Government should be about helping the people, not helping themselves.
Thank you. Jesus Chuy Garcia, 90 seconds.
I'll take this one standing up. The challenge of people who go unhoused has increased significantly since COVID. And things have worsened, and the issue has become much more severe. The solution, and I come at it as an urban planner from the University of Illinois at Chicago, is that we need to grow the supply. Folks have chimed in on the causes of people who wind up being unhoused. We've got to increase the production of housing, and we need to do it quickly. And there are measures that we can take to make it happen, including utilizing federal funds which are coming to Chicago thanks to the Infrastructure and Jobs Act and other measures that Congress has taken during the pandemic and in this post-recovery period, knock on wood. To increase the supply, we need to streamline and make it easier for nonprofit developers to build new housing on Chicago's South and West Sides. They're trying to do that, but the city can't be an obstacle that makes it harder. You have to turn the land over more quickly, remediate the land, and let them go. In addition to that, give them more access to capital and resources, remove the barriers so that we can begin to rebuild Chicago, rebuild it more equitably. Housing is a part of the solution. We need to increase it rapidly.
Thank you. And finally, Jay Mulgreen.
Let me just say, housing is a human right. And that must be the foundation of any administration in this city. Just a couple years ago, and I agree that there are two problems here, folks who are out on the street, as well as our affordable housing problem. But just a couple years ago, during the polar vortex, I had to sleep outside under the viaduct with folks who are unhoused because we couldn't get this administration to allow them to sleep in the police station while it was cold. That's not the type of administration that we will have. That's not the type of administration we will run. We must make sure that we give temporary housing for folks that are all throughout the city of Chicago while we are transitioning them into facilities. And we have to increase our affordable housing supply dramatically. So we talk about giving incentives to big box stores or single floor buildings throughout the city of Chicago and allow them to build a floor on top so we can increase our affordable housing supply. We got properties that we have already acquired, and we need to get private owners who have buildings that aren't being used and acquire them to increase our affordable housing supply dramatically. And we need an economic engine, which is why we're the only campaign to present an effort to have a public bank in the city of Chicago, where those resources we can just invest in income-based housing, invest into different facilities, and all of the profit that comes back goes right back to the city of Chicago, as well as the foundation of our PPP and $1,000 a month that will also go to folks who are homeless.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We move on now to the issue of abortion. January 22nd is the 50th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, and since the Supreme Court overturned it, Illinois abortions have increased by about 30%. With the influx of people traveling to Chicago, would you, as mayor, and how would you assist clinics and hospitals offering abortion? And we begin with Sophia King, 90 seconds.
Thank you for that question. Obviously, a very important question given the times and the legislation that just came down. As a former vice chair for Planned Parenthood Chicago area, I have always been on the forefront of making sure that women can control their bodies. That is definitely something that we need to underscore. And as women, we also need to take responsibility for that as well. We have power in women. We control votes to some extent. Are men, but we don't use that power actually. We are in this situation because of decisions women made years ago to put Trump, I hate to even say his name, in office, but we need to empower each other to make sure that we have the ability to make decisions like this. And what does that mean? It means when you control billions of dollars of government money, that you make sure women have access to that money. You make sure that minorities have access to that money. We have to make sure that we do. Like I said, we have a procurement system that is not set up to empower us as women. And as a leader of women, and as a black woman, I will make sure that we follow the money and that those resources get into our hands.
Thank you. Lori Lightfoot, 90 seconds.
When we found out about the leaked Supreme Court decision, we immediately sprung into action. The next day, I met with reproductive health care providers, and we committed an additional $500,000 that day to make sure that we could offset the necessary costs that these providers were experiencing already because of what happened in Texas, with women needing to come into the city of Chicago. And we looked around and knew about the trigger laws in the other states, and we knew that we had to do more. And what we've also done is in the budget that was just passed, and some of the people on this stage voted for that budget and some didn't, we put another $3 million in on top of that for making sure that the clinicians that are doing the Lord's work, women who are traveling, are protected. We passed a bodily autonomy, and first as an executive order and then as an ordinance, so that we would not cooperate with states who want to criminalize and drag into court women who are seeking to exercise their rights to reproductive health care services. You remember how you felt when you heard about that draft decision? You remember how you felt when Dobbs finally came down? It was like a punch in the gut. All of us were up in arms. All of us took to social media. All of us were doing everything that we could, except for Paul Vallis, who's been silent on this for 7 months until today at this forum. Shame on you, Paul, for not talking
thank
about
you,
women's
Mayor.
Rights
thank you,
until
Mayor.
Today.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Mayor. Roderick Sawyer, 90 seconds.
Thank you. Just very, very quickly, and I want to be extremely clear that under the Sawyer administration, we will do everything possible to continue on with reproductive rights services and gender-affirming care here in the city of Chicago. And we will also ensure and continue the work that's being done in making sure that those that are out of state in areas that have more restrictive laws will have a safe space to get that same care right here in Chicago.
Paul Vallis.
Well, thank you. Well, first of all, I am and have always been pro-choice. I've been a steadfast advocate for women's reproductive rights since I first began to work with Dawn Clark Netsch, whom I worked and partnered with and supported when she ran for public office for the better part of two decades. The facts are the facts. Also, as a candidate who has run for public office on prior occasions, I've always had the support of the advocacy community because of my stance as Pat Quinn, as Pat Quinn's running mate. As mayor, I pledge to work tirelessly to ensure that Chicago is a reproductive safe haven, not only for Chicagoans, but for anyone who comes to Chicago. That's a fact. That is my commitment. I will be unequivocal. And whatever financial supports are needed to make that happen, those financial supports will be provided. And I further pledge that when I talk about things like safe passage and safe communities, that also includes reproductive facilities and offices and services so they can be accessed free of intimidation. You know, Lori likes to invent new facts to suit her narrative. That dog doesn't hunt in this game. Thank you very much.
Willie Wilson, 90 seconds.
Well, that's a question that you asked. No one has a answer for it. Half of the country, pro-choice, the other one, pro-life. I'm pro-choice. I don't have a right to tell anybody what to do in their private home or their particular life. But we are a person that have worked and experienced life. And I experienced life so much until I found out that I thought I was right. It took me 20 years to figure I had been wrong. Life teaches you things. But I am in support of talking together and work together to work whatever situation there is to work out. That's a question that I can't answer for no one, particularly the female, but we sit and we talk together and work it out. I believe in freedom of speech, freedom of choice.
Thank you. Jesus Chuy Garcia, 90 seconds.
To me, true choice means more than just my body, my choice. It means having real access to abortion services. It means having real access to maternal care, as well as when women are pregnant. It will also mean in the coming days, as it does already, that we need to work collaboratively with people like Governor Pritzker, with legislative leaders, with President of the Board, Tony Preckwinkle, to generate more resources. But we also need to consult with the sponsors of this forum, women who understand the urgency and how we need to attend to all of the growing needs that refugees from states that have banned access to abortion services will come here seeking refuge. I will take that direction and that leadership from you because you are the experts. But I will roll up my sleeves and work with other partners to ensure that there is access to health care for women, that there is gender-affirming health care access as well. That is how we move on in the challenges until we reverse the decision or until Congress passes a law that makes access to abortion services universal in every state.
Jamal Green, 90 seconds.
Well, I'm not only pro-choice, but I'm pro-woman. And at the end of the day, in our city, women are unprotected, they're humiliated, they're embarrassed all the time in politics. We must make sure that the access is there for those who are coming into our city. We must also make sure that there aren't men continuing to believe that they can govern a woman's body. A woman has agency over her body, and they will always have it under our administration. As the only man in my family, coming from two sisters and a mother, I have to say that I'm not just pro-choice, I'm pro-women, just like the disrespect of Anjanette Young or many different women throughout our city that are constantly disrespected by this administration and government. We must take a stand and step up and show them that we will protect them, that we will be there for them. And in regards to making sure that they have access to healthcare in this city, we need to make sure there is an unlimited amount of resources for those here and those who come here to seek refuge. I will always be pro-woman under our administration.
Thank you. Brandon Johnson, 90 seconds, please.
You know, the three most important women in my life, my daughter, Braden, my mother-in-law, we call her Meemaw, and the woman who is my best friend that I get to go to sleep with every single night. It's my wife, Stacy, who is also a doula, by the way. And so when we talk about reproductive support and healthcare, This is something that is dear to me personally. We do know that because of the lack of health care, particularly afforded to women of color, there's a disproportionate impact of infant mortality rates that are far more severe within our communities. And so that's why I firmly believe that we have to see sanctuary as one of the most precious things that government can offer. When women are fleeing other countries, fleeing violence, we have to be sanctuary. In fact, I actually believe that we have a real opportunity under my administration to demonstrate real collaboration, working with the Cook County Public Health Department, the city's public health department, having worked as a Cook County commissioner where we've provided hundreds of millions of dollars for health care. That becomes a major part of the work that we have to do. And I think the last thing is that we also have to recognize that the entities and the forces that want to block the sanctity of a woman's right, these are the same institutions that have denied that there was ever a pandemic. These are the same entities that believe that the only way in which you can make this country great is to make it great again. And unfortunately, we have too many folks on this stage that have a policing strategy that doesn't keep us safe.
Thank you. Let's move to the topic of education. Even though there are fewer students in Chicago public schools today, they still are at a disadvantage when it comes to funding. According to the State Board of Education data, there's $2,500 less per pupil than is called for. How do you fix it? Let's begin with Lori Lightfoot.
We've got to get more money from Springfield, bottom line. We've got to make sure that every single state rep and every single senator understands that their obligation is to make sure that our public school system is fully funded. And they don't get it. They think that the work that was done in the prior administration is good enough. It's not. We do not have enough resources to make sure that every single student is able to learn in a safe and nurturing environment. So we've got to keep pushing, as I have done, talking to the governor, talking to the legislative leaders, and I'm not going to rest until we get more, and particularly we get our fair share of resources from Springfield. But meanwhile, we've got to play the cards that were dealt. And what we are doing is making sure that the investments in every school across our city are even and level. That's critically important. We got to live up to, as we have been, our contractual obligations with the Chicago Teachers Union to make sure that we've got those social workers, that we've got the nurses, we've got the other things that are necessary to help support that school environment. And frankly, what we also need to do is make sure that we invest more resources on the time period of 0 to 5 years, because kids have to be ready to learn when they get to kindergarten. The data is clear. If they're not, the trajectory is this way. If they are, it's this way, and the sky's the limit. We've got to invest in our kids, no matter what the circumstances are, and that is what we have been doing in my administration.
Thank you. Roderick Sawyer for 90 seconds.
Obviously, this is a very serious issue. As we're seeing that the costs are continuing to escalate in Chicago public schools over the last 3 years, I think the costs have escalated over 60%, at the same time while enrollments decreased 9%. That's a recipe that's always destined to fail. We have to work out that inequity. We have to make sure that we're investing to make sure that everything that we do is investing in students, teachers, and anything that's required for learning. You know, not bloated administrative expenses, not excessive money spent on facilities that are outdated. We need to make sure that we're laser focused on ensuring that what we're doing is going to benefit each and every child in the Chicago public schools. And under our administration, we're going to do that day one. We're going to root out the mismanagement and the excess spending. We're going to look at every item that needs to be looked at right now to make sure that everything that we do is focused on educating our children, the leaders of our future. And if we don't do that, we're not the people that we say we are. When we have schools that are under-enrolled and we have people that are not living up, only 0% that are living at grade level, this is something that we need to be looking at. Being focused on what we can do to better educate our children solely, nothing else but that.
Thank you. Paul Vallis.
Well, thank you. Right now we're spending $30,000 per student And since 2019, the enrollment has declined by 11% and the funding per pupil has gone up by 40%. Is that enough money? I'm not suggesting it's not. No one has worked harder to get more money for schools in the largest districts in four different states than me, including negotiating the biggest FEMA settlement in public school history in New Orleans. Where's the money going? Where's the money going? $30,000 a kid. Do you see it in the classroom? Right now, only 60% of the money that goes to the Chicago Public Schools, 60% of your property taxes, 25% of all the state funding finds its way into the classrooms, 60%. Why are the campuses closed at 2:30, 3 o'clock, 3:30 at night? Why are the campuses closed on weekends? Why are the campuses closed during holidays, or for that matter, are open only a limited period of time, despite the fact that over 200 kids who have been murdered in the city of Chicago since 2019, and the crimes being committed by school-aged children has skyrocketed to record levels. One commonality, 95% of the crimes, 95% of the murders, children not in school. We've got to make sure that the money flows to the local schools. We've got to open the campuses through the weekends, over the summer, on the holidays, and bring the community-based organizations and park district programs to the campuses so the kids have a place and secure place to go. We've got to create universal work-study in all of our schools. Brendan talked about that, so that every single high school student can have an opportunity to be work-study so we can pull them off the street and keep them in a safe and secure place.
Thank you. Willie Wilson for 90 seconds.
I think the education system that we have today, school teachers, in my opinion, is not being treated fairly. They don't make enough income to help motivate them to teach our students. Yeah. Next is that some of the courses and things that you're giving into school, I think should be added to it. Obviously, we got to find the necessary dollars to do so. But some of the courses, I would make sure that before you can pass from one grade to the next grade, that you will have a trade to start building infrastructure for those communities that need help. In order to generate dollars, you must bring in businesses. You bring in businesses by lowering taxes. You bring in business, international business, by lowering taxes but not raising taxes. You know, you keep the citizen in Chicago by making sure that we don't raise taxes and keep them shopping in Chicago by not going to the suburban. So when you bring international business in, it attract more people to the city of Chicago. The sales goes up and people begin to have a good tax base to make sure we can afford these type of things. So I really support us getting together in terms of working with major corporations and bringing major corporations together that we can figure it out, giving tax incentive, lowering taxes.
Thank you.
Not putting taxes on the citizens and run them out of the city.
Thank you. Jesus Chuy Garcia for 90 seconds.
As the parent of three children who attended Chicago Public Schools and the grandparent of five grandchildren in Chicago Public Schools, I truly understand how urgent it is to properly fund our schools. We need to move away from our over-reliance on property taxes, which is causing so much great harm, including in Chicago, displacement of people who live in or near gentrifying areas. How do we do this? We can work with the General Assembly to double the amount of funding for Chicago schools. In order to do that, however, you need to be collaborative. You need to have a good relationship with the governor, with legislative leaders, with members of both chambers in the Illinois General Assembly. As a stakeholder and the only person on stage who has worked to make schools the center of community, opening them up after school hours for all kinds of activities for children, for parents, and for other members of the community, which reduces the incidence of violence in the schools. I get it, I understand it, and understand the urgency of adequately funding our schools, and we should make an effort once again to move away and establish a fairer tax system in Illinois that doesn't rely so greatly on regressive property taxes to fund the children and their future.
Thank you. Jamal Green for 90 seconds.
Well, you know, let me just say, we talk about funding and all of the municipalities, But we have somebody here at the table at every level of government in the state and in the feds. And somehow, when they say that they have urgency, I don't see it. We do not see the collaboration and the work coming down to Chicago Public Schools. As a father of three boys in public schools, it is so important that we restructure how our public school system operates. Our kids are being failed each and every single day. I got a congressman, I got a commissioner, I got alderman, I got a mayor. I got folks here who have the ability to act right now, not when they become mayor. And at the end of the day, we need the urgency to make sure that young kids as young as 3 years old, we introduced a program, Universal 3K. We should have programming for kids as young as 3 years old to start getting the skills they need so that it sets them up for their future. We got to make sure that we got the wraparound services in our school system from counselors to clinical staff members so that they get the support that they need each and every day. I mean, right now, we're using enrollment-based formula. It needs to change to needs-based formula because we got schools that go that are under enrollment and they lose funding. That should not be happening. We should not be allowing our schools to be under-enrolled and then shut them down and leave dozens of buildings that's still in our city right now today. We have to change that. We have to invest in the institutions and make them institutions where everyone wants to send their kids, no matter the neighborhood.
Thank you. Brandon Johnson for 90 seconds.
Hold your applause, please.
Yeah, thank you. I'm the only person on this stage who has literally sacrificed my body for public education. Went on a hunger strike. I did. Because of the failures of previous administrations, there's no one on this stage that has more of an incentive for the public schools to work than someone who was sending their children to public schools. My wife and I, we send our children in the opposite directions every single day, 25 minutes northwest, 25 minutes south, because there isn't a fully funded neighborhood school in our neighborhood that actually offers orchestra. Look, I've been on the picket line, been on the front line. The reason why there's an elected representative school board, because I was a part of the structure that actually put the measure on the ballot in order to put it on the decks of the governor. You're not gonna have to sue my administration over special education like we've had to sue this administration. You won't have to do that. Look, what's really unfair is the fact that the people who are supporting my candidacy, like SEIU healthcare workers, in which I'm fully supportive of universal child care for all. What's really unfair is the fact that Dr. Willie Wilson pays the same tax rate as child care workers. 71% of residents of this city said that we believe in a fair tax structure, a progressive income tax. And that's why my administration is going to work with Senator Don Harmon, the Senate President, the Speaker of the House, Chris Welch, the Governor, to make sure that the city of Chicago actually gets what it deserves. And the fact that Paul Vallis, who has privatized public education all over this country, is even on the stage having a conversation about public education, is morally bankrupt.
Can we just ask, could we please ask the audience, we know you're passionate about this, but let everybody have a chance.
We're gonna move.
Sophia King.
Thank you. As an educator, never say a former educator when you're a teacher because you're always teaching. I do agree that we need more money from Springfield, and I do agree that we need more collaboration and not confrontation in order to get that money and bring it home. We have to be able to collaborate with our state partners, with our county partners, in order to make sure we have the resources that we need. But as a teacher, and as an alderman of a ward that sees some of the disparity, I represent Kenwood High School, one of the best neighborhood high schools in the city. It has test scores like a selective enrollment school of mine, Jones High School, same ward. I see the disparities in resources, which is why I stood up to make sure that Kenwood looked like it did on the outside with what was going on with education on the inside. So we have to make sure that that equity is there. It's also the school that you send your son to. You know I was going to put that out there. But we've got to make sure we've got equitable distribution of resources. Another thing is low-hanging fruit. We can teach our kids about college and the trades and the tech industry. We have to bring the trades and the tech back to our schools in a meaningful way. We should be the Silicon Valley of the Midwest, but we have to train our kids in order to receive those resources that are coming down the
line. Thank you.
We move now to talk a little bit about trades. Construction jobs provide high wages, full benefits, good for families. But why in Chicago, where women and men are equally represented in the population, less than 5% in the construction trades are women? The city will be spending big bucks soon on publicly supported projects like the new casino and Lincoln Yards. So how would you work to remedy the inequity of the construction workforce on city-funded projects? Let's begin with Roderick Sawyer.
Obviously, this is something that's problematic, both with gender and with race as it relates to the trades. This is something that has to be dealt with intentionality, and it leads from the top. As mayor, I'm going to make sure that I have constant contact with our individual trade unions and make sure that we have programs that are continue to be available for women, for others that need to be access to this program. It needs to be much more. I do agree with Sophia King about having trades in schools. We need to really look at that and dive into that on a more local level. Furthermore, there used to be a school on the west side that had a manufacturing program. I think it got discontinued some years ago under the Emanuel administration. I was able to visit there. And their provision was you leave Friday with a diploma, Monday with a job. You know, these are things that we have to continue to expand, particularly for women. I have women that come to my office all the time, women in trades that try to get a leg up. I am proud to have worked on things like the MBI program, which is gender neutral. That was something that I worked on. I was one of the lead sponsors in that. Setting aside particular projects, just identifying for people like women-owned contractors, for example, to have an opportunity to bid without having others like the large groups, I won't mention any names, the large groups bid against them and sometimes drive those bids down so that these construction companies would not have an opportunity otherwise. So I'm proud to have been a part of that. I've been doing the work. I've continued to do the work, and I want to make sure that they have everyone has an every opportunity, particularly women in the trade program.
Thank you. Paul Vallis, 90 seconds.
Well, the way you do it is you set realistic goals, and then you remove obstacles. When Gary Chico and I put together the $3.2 billion school construction program, we set our goals, 50% minority women-owned businesses, 50% minority hiring, because we all know sometimes minority companies won't hire a large number of minority workers, and 50% city residents. We exceeded those goals. $1.7 $8 billion in salaries went to a minority woman, and we did not double count. We did not double count. We had separate categories for each. Now, how we were able to do that? How we were able to do that despite the fact that many of the companies that we hired did not have union labor? Easily, I negotiated a project labor agreement, which basically said these companies can hire their workers, whoever they want, if they're non-union labor, if they pay prevailing wage, if they become signatories during the course of that contract. And we got full approval, and we got full support. We also did something else, and Alderman Sawyer and I have talked to this from time to time. We also removed the obstacles to minority businesses actually getting contracts. You know how we did that? We insured them. I pulled all the insurance, all the bonding out of some of the big bond houses, some of the big insurance houses that were shaking down minority contractors, and we provided them with wraparound insurance. So the whole idea was, oh, the business, they don't have the experience, so they can't get to work. Well, they don't have the work because they can't get the bonding. They can't get the bonding because they don't have the experience. We insured them. So what? Imagine if you applied that strategy to the $28 billion that the mayor of the city of Chicago controls in annual spending with all the governmental agencies combined.
Thank you. Willie Wilson, 90 seconds.
Okay, I think you need to set up a task force within the mayor's office to make sure, oversee that the females are getting equal opportunity and equality for all the citizens, and make sure that everything is being spent, that they get their portion of it. And also putting the infrastructure in place and make sure that we have a good training task force for those who maybe like some type of training that didn't go to a trade school and get the skills and things that needed to be in order to get those particular jobs. And if I may respond to my colleague down here for a moment, in terms of tax dollars, for Brother Johnson, I give away 100% of all the money that I owe. I pay a lot of taxes. I pay probably 100 times taxes than you pay. I want to let you know that. And but also I have 1,000 of people as well, so I want to let you know that. And then plus I'm not bought. I don't have any special interest paying for my campaign. I pay 100% of it.
Thank you. Jesus Chuy Garcia.
Thank you. The landmark legislation that we've passed in Congress that includes the Infrastructure and Jobs Act will continue to deliver for Chicago as one of the centers with the greatest amount of transportation and infrastructure in the country, whether it's modernizing the airports, whether it's fixing the interstate highways, freight rail, commuter rail, or our waterways. This will create great opportunities to close the gap on the lack of people and women in the building trades, a historic opportunity. I've let it be known to trade unions that I'm going to sit with them to negotiate goals and concrete measures for achieving that. We need more people of color and more women working in those jobs and all the job opportunities that there will be. In addition to that, there will be great investments in the area of technology through the CHIPS and Science Act. We need to create the pipeline so that young people in elementary school, in high school, have career pathways that don't require necessarily a college education and the indebtedness that comes with that. And finally, I would submit to you that in the Inflation Reduction Act, forget about the title, it's really the investment in solar and other green energy like heat pumps that can come to people's houses all over Chicago in the form of tax credits will be something that will help us rebuild Chicago in an equitable manner, produce new housing, and make sure that people also have broadband.
Thank you so much. I need a little broadband, Congressman. You know, we look back, when I look back years ago, when I look back to our several mayors that we've had, our last great mayor, Harold Washington, was one person who made sure that he had women at the centerpiece of his campaign and of his administration, making sure that women were represented all throughout the administration, as well as making it fairer for them to get contracts to do business with the city of Chicago and others. And so, you know, I want to say that women are the most resilient. They are the most intelligent, and as my better half say, you know, they get shit done. And we got to make sure that the city of Chicago is doing everything in its power to make sure that they have access to the opportunities that everyone else has. When you look at the percentage from the city as well as the state and the contracting process, it is abysmal to see the amount of women that actually have obtained these contracts and minorities. So we got to step in, and I agree with Paul on making sure that the barriers that are in place, that we step in and we ensure them so that they can have the capacity to win these bids. We got to remove all of those barriers as a city and make women the centerpiece and make sure that we increase the percentage of contracting throughout the city of Chicago dramatically.
Thank you. I'm really grateful to have the support of many of the labor groups that exist today, especially because the vast majority of the labor groups that support me are women. And, you know, Dr. Wilson, if you want to contribute more to my campaign, by all means, brandonforchicago.com. You know, but look, the program that Alderman Sawyer was referring to is at Austin High School. And when the city of Chicago removed its support from this high school on the west side of Chicago, it was the Chicago Teachers Union Foundation that actually stepped up to actually fund to keep the program going. That obviously is not sustainable, because I actually believe that the government has a responsibility to continue to grow opportunities for women in the trades. And this is why I am not just proud of the workforce development expansion that we've done at the county board, where hundreds of millions of dollars through the equity plan is geared towards that type of development, but we also have to make sure that we have leadership that understands the value of women working. And unfortunately, for too long in this country, particularly in this city, women have been devalued. Public education in and of itself, at the expense of the state, after all, is a Negro idea. That's W.E.B. Du Bois. So the public schools in and of itself has a responsibility, particularly to diversify the workforce, is to continue to support measures, and I will do that, to ensure that people have opportunity. The trillions of dollars that are coming through the infrastructure plan, we have an opportunity to improve our infrastructure and put women in particular to work. Thank you.
Sophia King. Yep. Thank you. I think leading by example is an important thing so that we understand actually what's happening. I have a ward that has billions of dollars of investment. And the average participation we have for minorities is around 44% or over. When you see that the city's floor is 26-6 and most people don't even hit that, that's actually remarkable. It shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that way. In the schools, I last talked about we need to bring the trades back to the schools. That's the fifth floor that needs to leverage the power that they have there to lead that effort. We shouldn't have apprentice programs that are way in the suburbs where our kids can't access them. They need to be in the schools so they can understand how much money they can make. They can come out making $80,000 with HVAC training. So those are resources. And I will respectfully say to Mr. Garcia that if you really believe in bringing us together, you should give back the money that you took from Local 150, who wants you to lead an ordinance that would exclude African-American businesses from that. They came to me with the same deal. And so we need to make sure that there's equity out there. We need to make sure that we hold people accountable and that we don't exclude people by happenstance.
Thank you. Lori Lightfoot.
Paul Vallis said to you, imagine if, and then he rattled off a lot of things that might happen. Ladies and gentlemen, you don't have to imagine it. It's getting done on my watch, on my administration. 26-6, we blew through that number, as reported to the city council. We have put tens of millions of dollars of more wealth into women-owned, minority-owned businesses than has happened in the last 10-plus years. You don't have to imagine it. It's being done. You do it by working with Chicago Women's in Trade and make sure that they've got the resources and support they need. Now, they tried to turn me into a welder, but I thought, nah, that's not the best use of my talent. But we've got to make sure that those women are supported and funded. You also do it by doing things like with the Carpenters Union. They have put together a unique apprenticeship program with the city colleges where we're putting more people to jobs. They're getting their apprenticeship. They're getting their associate's degree. That's happening right now. We announced that last year. You do it by making sure that our kids actually see the possibility of the jobs that are available, those well-paying union jobs. That's why we hosted the first ever union trade fair last year at McCormick Place. 3,000 elementary and high school students went through that, hosting it again, and we're going to increase the number so they could see the bricklayers, the roofers, the jobs that they could get right now without a high school degree. You don't have to just imagine and talk about a value statement. We're getting it done now.
All right. Let's go to food deserts. Why have there been no consistent, sustainable progress in eliminating food deserts, especially on the south and the west sides? What will you be able to do that others just have not managed to do, to not only get a grocery store, but keep a grocery store? Paul Vallis, 90 seconds.
I think what the city has to do is get into the food service business. I mean, food deserts is an environmental issue, whether it's getting let out of the drinking water or not providing children with access to quality family, access to quality falls, food, it's an environmental issue. I think that's the approach that the city has to take is to be proactive in opening food centers, in opening food marketplaces, and then contracting out with the type of providers who have broad networks and are providing quality foods to come in and to manage those facilities. The problem that you have now is when you try, you have to give enormous incentives for these companies to come in. You give them $10 million incentives to locate in this community or that community, and then ultimately, when it becomes too cost effective, after those incentives are gone, they move out. I think the city has got to get into the business of opening food centers, of opening food stations, and contracting out with the type of providers who have the type of network so that there is access to quality foods. I think over time, as those facilities stabilize, those facilities could then be turned over to local ownership, to local co-ops. But I think the city, because we're playing games here, and even some of the companies that we're trying to bring in, they're like, we're bringing in the dollar store version of food pantries, and that's what we're doing. We need the top providers to come in. But if we open the facilities and we provide the funding and the property tax abatements for those facilities, we can bring the pros in to manage it.
Thank you. Willie Wilson.
I think we have to partnership with major corporation, give them incentive, talk with them, get them into the community. Right now, you got the food desert. Some of the neighborhood is not crime. No one wants to put businesses in an area where it's high crime, you know. So we have to take care of that, of course. But I think by being a business person, I understand how to work with major corporations. I do it all the time. There's one language that we all speak, and that we speak money. That one language we speak, and that one language that I do understand. And so we have to get and talk and work together, bring them in. As a business person for numbers of different years, we've seen it happen around the world, and we can make that happen without a issue for my particular experience and relationship that we have with a lot of major corporations.
Thank you. Chuy Garcia.
There's been a lot of talk about food deserts in Chicago for a long time, but food deserts continue to persist. They persist because the city has not had a comprehensive strategy of community development. Community development, successful development, occurs when you link housing to transportation, to healthcare, and to retail. Invest Southwest are really the vestiges of the Emanuel administration with a Lightfoot brand on them. And you've read the stories in the newspapers, they just aren't working. They're not working because they're not thought through. As a graduate of the University of Illinois Urban Planning Program, my commitment will be to mobilize resources into those communities, to use federal funding to invest in housing, to make transportation accessible, reliable, safe, and clean for everyone in Chicago, and to ensure that there's access to health care for people all over. The city and the county need to collaborate in the clinic networks that they have, 24 and 14 respectively. That's how you deliver those health care services. Comprehensive community development will be the mainstay policy of ensuring that we put an end to these food desert persistence for such a long time.
Thank you. Jamal Green.
You know, I agree that there isn't a comprehensive plan in this administration to address this problem. And I look back to one of the cases recently when Whole Foods closed in Inglewood, and somehow the administration said, oh, we didn't know. Well, that's a problem. If a corporation who've got incentives to build is in these communities and decide to shut down and does not communicate with the mayor's office, that is a real problem. So somehow, you know, I heard the mayor said that they tried to get her to be a welder. Maybe that's a better job than being mayor, because unfortunately, we are in communities struggling with the fact that folks in these communities don't have access to fresh produce. They're living miles away, Oak Gill Gardens, finally have a private person to come in to say they're going to build a grocery store? Why throughout the city of Chicago there are communities that don't have access to fresh produce? So you know what we did with Whole Foods? We said, well, since we don't have a grocery store now, we partner with our company, Sunbend Solar, partner with Love Fridge and Getting Grown Collective to put a fresh free fridge of produce where people can access it all day, every day, until we get another grocery store in Inglewood. We need to step up and put together a comprehensive plan on making sure we address food deserts. So tomorrow, MLK Day, we'll be giving away more groceries to another food desert on the east side at 8240 South Stony Island. We do it every week, and we did it throughout the pandemic.
Thank you. Brandon Johnson.
So the reason why there are just persistent food deserts in the city of Chicago is because of structural inequality and racism. You know, many of the businesses that have left leave because they would much rather escape having to put some skin in the game to ensure that equity and justice actually exist. And that's why you actually have to have a comprehensive plan in which, you know, as an organizer, you know, we have seen throughout the city of Chicago what's possible when we work together. And so we have individuals that within my administration as the mayor of Chicago who are moving community gardens as we build capacity to bring grocery stores into the city of Chicago, that we actually work with the individuals who are prepared to lead today, because accessibility is the big thing. Look, I live in Austin. One of the grocery stores that is used, quite frankly, from residents in Austin, it's in Oak Park, and so much revenue leaves Austin to this particular grocery store that they're building another one in Oak Park. Look, black and brown folks are ready and prepared to spend. You need a mayor that actually values and understands that to make sure that we are using all of our levers, we're using all levels of government to come up with a comprehensive plan to deliver that. But in the meantime, we have to make sure that individuals who are working within communities to bring real holistic food locally to the community, that you have an administration that is committed to that. Thank you.
Sophia King.
Yeah, thank you. I think the biggest issue is really driving economic development in those communities that are experiencing food insecurity. And I think the biggest driver of economic development in communities are around education, good schools. You're not going to move into a community unless you have a good school for your child to go to. And also safety. Safety and education. We need to make sure we prioritize those two things. I also think that there should be incentives, better incentives around driving that economic development. So I would continue, I would use TIFs, as Harold Washington suggested that we did, you know, to drive economic development in under-resourced communities. But I would also use something that this administration hasn't taken advantage of, which is opportunity zones. And those are areas where we can take our capital gains, take the money we have, put them into those areas, and come out after 10 years with tax-free dollars. That's an incentive for everybody to invest. We can grow all of our money, our communities, with opportunity zones as an incentive. And they're all in under-resourced communities. So we have a number of these tools. We're using it as Michael Reese, which is being heralded as one of the most equitable developments in the country, because we have a $25 million commitment to schools. We have a commitment to 20% affordable housing on site. So I would continue to use that as a tool for incentives. Thank you.
Lori Lightfoot.
Well, you tackle the decades in the making long problem of food deserts by empowering somebody in the mayor's office, as I have done, whose only job is to make sure that she's coordinating across all city agencies, the private sector, not-for-profits, to focus on getting something done. And that work has led to a $13.5 billion investment in a company, black-led company, called Yellow Banana, that is going into neighborhoods on the south and side to make sure that we are creating grocery store options, like the one in Alderman David Moore's ward in Auburn Gresham. You do that by supporting the burgeoning food and agriculture, urban agriculture community here in the city, by providing free water, as we have done, and providing land, and making sure that they're getting their their fair share of city, state, and federal resources. You do that, with due respect, Congressman, by Invest Southwest and making sure that you put real dollars into these neighborhoods. $2.5 billion is not warmed over hash, Congressman. 40 years in public service. Where is your economic development plan that has changed the fortunes of neighborhoods across the South and the West Side? Concrete, tangible steps, ladies and gentlemen, is how you get it done. Of course, you got to have the value statement, but you got to turn that value statement into real action, and that's what we've done for 4 years, and that's what we're going to do for four more.
Thank you. Roderick Sawyer.
In response to this question, I had an opportunity to talk with someone that had an answer, because I did not, and it happened to be my brother-in-law. My brother-in-law was one of the last black-owned grocers in the city of Chicago, owned Chatham Foods. And he informed me that the big challenge to have, and even when he sold his company, he could not find an African-American to buy it. One of the key problems is the low margins in the grocery business. Groceries, probably next to gasoline, is probably one of the lowest margin businesses that are out here right now. What we have to do is, one, rethink what we buy. We don't always have to shop at the big behemoth grocery stores. We should support local initiatives like Grow Greater Inglewood, who is growing their food, growing it and providing it to restaurants and others that are willing to come purchase it. We need to be investing in them. We need to be investing in places like a co-op in my ward, who's run by ex-offenders, who's providing food services to businesses and other area individuals. We have to just refocus and reset what we're doing right now and look at local grocers, specialized grocers, areas that we can say that we can make investments in from the city to assist them in doing this. Because once they do that, if they're growing locally, we don't have to deal with middlemen or trucking companies and all the other things that are doing. We can buy directly from them. We can buy, that's a cost savings to us, and it's increasing their margin because they don't have to do all the things necessary to make money. So we need to look at local.
Thank you very much.
You know, during any mayoral campaign, the focus is often on the city's shortcomings and really what doesn't work. So our final question for you today is for you to just take a moment to talk about what you like about Chicago and how would you convince anyone that it's a good place to live and a good place to visit. Let's start off with you, Willie Wilson.
Well, I've been to Chicago since 1965. Chicago is a nice city. It's people. You can relate. It's not a city like, maybe I said if I go to New York, I go to bed, you're up. Like in less than an hour, you seem like Chicago. It's different. Chicago got good feeling. It's landscape, it's people, it's building, it's architect, all those kind of things there as well. The one thing I really don't like about Chicago, the crime is too high. Taxes are too high. People not really taking in putting these people first. It's about the party. You Democrat or you Republican, you do what the party says versus what the people want. We have to change that. We have to be genuine and sincere about it. I'm not retired. I work all the time, but I'm not going to take a paycheck from the city of Chicago. I don't want it. I don't need it. I wouldn't take it. I'm donating this time just to try to pull it together to help because I love Chicago. And I think that we have to all take a look at ourselves and say that what's more important to us, you know. I wouldn't even, as become mayor of Chicago, I wouldn't even allow the people who get contracted to donate to my campaign.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Period.
Thank you, sir. Jesus Chuy Garcia, what do you like about this city?
So Chicago's still the greatest city in the world, and although it's hurting and people are feeling unsafe, it is a world-class city. but it can become a much more greater class city. Why do we love Chicago? Because we are gritty people. We have the best food here in the country. We have the best music here in the country. We have great architecture. We have grit, and we have neighborhood festivals. And we may be severely segregated still, but we're trying to inch forward. And I believe that with everything we've endured, with the pandemic, with the racial reckoning, that more Chicagoans than ever, whether they're people who live downtown in the high rises and control much of the economy, get it, that we can't continue to grow and develop this way, that we need equity, that we need to figure out formulas for making it happen. I think all Chicagoans are striving to be proud of the city and to change your reputation and for people to be able to go anywhere and say, hey, I hear good things are happening in Chicago. Come and check us out. Come and check out our food. Come and check out our music. Come and check out our neighborhoods and our great architecture. And yes, we've got the greatest water source in the world right here in the shores of Chicago.
Jamal Green. 90 seconds.
Chicago is the best place on earth. And I love Chicago so much because of the hope that everyone in Chicago has, that we can be better. The hope of the 20,000 homeless young people that are out there still working their butts off because they know their life is greater. The work of those teachers who still walk in those classrooms each and every day that don't have the resources that they need to teach. But each and every day they go to those school buildings and they are teachers and educating young people. The hope of the folks throughout the community, in the face of bullet wounds, in the face of gunshots, in the face of carjacking, in the face of the endless corruption, folks know in Chicago that we can become better. And I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that with all of us in this room and all of us throughout this city that's working each and every day to make sure that Chicago can have a future that we can all believe in together. I am hopeful that we will create a future that our kids want to raise a family in and our kids' kids want to raise a family in. And that's why I'm raising my family in the city of Chicago and running for mayor of the city of Chicago to make sure that we can fulfill the promise of our city. You can go to GoGreenChicago.com to see our platform. Jamal Green, I'm running for mayor of Chicago. Thank you.
Thank you. Brandon Johnson, 90 seconds.
So the best thing about the city of Chicago, it's the people of the city of Chicago, where the rest of the country learns what real protest looks like. As democracy is being curtailed all around the country, it was the people of Chicago that said democracy should be in our Chicago public schools. Look, the best job that I've ever had is that of a public school teacher. I taught in Cabrini-Green, USA, which is like it's the essence of the city of Chicago. Right, because my students could look out their back windows and they could see one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the entire city. But unfortunately, out of their front windows, they saw bulldozers preparing to destroy their public housing. And unfortunately, that type of brutal inequality has been too pervasive. And I'm running for mayor of Chicago because I believe that not only can we have a better Chicago, but we can finally retire this tale of two cities. Here's why I'm hopeful. Chicago is the largest small town in the world where everybody knows a little bit about everybody. That's what makes our city strong. That's what makes our city prosperous because we lean on one another. We rely upon one another to build the type of political program that has now made everybody a progressive. But here's the best part about Chicago, that I am the son of a pastor and a carpenter. A lot of pressure growing up when your daddy wants you to be like Jesus. A public school teacher in a position to lead one of the most powerful cities in the world, I am more confident today that anything is possible in the city of Chicago.
Thank you so much. Sophia King.
Yeah, so as others have said, we live in the best city in the world, undeniably. And I think part of the reason is because we're the most affordable place. We're not like New York or San Francisco. You can actually live in Chicago very nicely. We have water, as somebody else mentioned. California, the West Coast, they don't have water, which is why we need to have a Department of Environment. That is important to make sure we continue to have safe water to drink. In order to, I would say our diversity is actually our biggest strength, so we need to celebrate that unabashedly. Our diversity is that. But in order to keep us strong, in order to keep us as one of the best global cities in the world, we have to come together. We have to lead with collaboration and not confrontation. We need to be together as one. We know that we can both uplift our police and hold them accountable. We can have safety and justice. We can build our downtowns and we can build our neighborhoods. We can teach our kids about college and the trades. Let's stop all the false narratives. We have to come together. We are the city of big shoulders. Let's act like it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lori Lightfoot, 90 seconds.
I learned through one of the toughest times that this city has ever been through. A global pandemic that could have knocked us to our knees. What I learned is that this city is tough, it's resilient, and we came together. That's what makes our city great. That's the thing that I love. Whether it's Rogers Park or Roseland, or it's the West Side, Southeast Side, Southwest Side, there are people in the city who are working hard every single day to build a life for themselves, to build a life for their families and their kids, to pass down wealth, and are unapologetic, as I am, about being fierce defenders of who we are, our way of life. And it doesn't matter who challenges us, because that happens every day. And it could be the most powerful person in the world when the former president put our name in his mouth in a way that was denigrating and disturbing. I stood up and fought because you wanted me to do that, to celebrate our way of life. We lead delegations all over the country, all over this world, talking about the great strength of this city. And we always talk about the resiliency, the toughness, the intellect, the creativity and innovation of you, our residents, our people. That's the greatest thing that we have here in Chicago.
Thank you. Roderick Sawyer, 90 seconds.
Wow. I was born on 70th and Rhodes here in Chicago's Park Manor community. I was afforded a great education. I was afforded an opportunity to work, went to law school, all right here in Chicago. I could have gone anywhere in the country to reside. I've stayed here. It was a commitment. It was a choice. It wasn't circumstance. I stayed here because I love this city, and I want to make it grow. I want to work together with people like you, everyone here, to make sure that we have the best city possible. Love its diversity. Even though we are segregated, I've been in every single community in this city, all 77 communities. It's very inviting, and I want to make sure that we continue that. This morning, I was in Mount Greenwood. People are like, you were in Mount Greenwood? I was in Mount Greenwood this morning. Had a good time, had breakfast, and interacted with a lot of people, and people were very encouraging and inviting. So you got to not be afraid. You have to explore all your areas. You got to look at the culture, look at the people, look at the food. Sorry, look at the food. It's the best in the world. But all these things together are what makes Chicago great. And the most important thing, again, like a lot of us said here today, are its people. You are the reason that Chicago is great. It's the reason that Chicago is going to be greater. And with me as your mayor, we are going to reset and make things even better. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Paul Vallis.
Well, thank you very much. Look, there's no greater city in the United States than Chicago, and there's no city that has greater potential. Our geographical location, our great universities, our great institutions, our great healthcare system, the diversity of the city, the city of communities, the city of neighborhoods, our experience, our history, our vigor, our determination to overcome every problem. Chicago's biggest problem is its government, its biggest flaw of its government. It's a $28 billion institution. And every single problem that we're facing today, the problems of public safety, the degrading of the police department, the failure to comply with the consent decree, the problems of a failed education system, a system that shut your schools down for 15 months with devastating consequences, the problems of a tax and spend and budget cycle that increases your property taxes almost $900 million despite $6 billion in COVID money and now forecasts another structural deficit next year. It's the problems of bad leadership on the fifth floor. And it didn't begin with this mayor. At the end of the day, the greatest tonic for bad leadership is good leadership. The type of leadership that can not only come in, at least with a vision, but more importantly, the type of leadership who can assemble a team that's homegrown, who knows what to do with the police department, knows what to do with public safety, knows what to do with the educational system. Every single school district I have run in four different cities, I have promoted from within, always promoting from within. So at the end of the day, we have the leadership here to move the city forward. Thank you.
What I love about Chicago is that you spent a Saturday for 2 hours here with us.